Hey, everybody. Welcome to another great episode of the OIG Roundtable. We got a lot to cover. We're all here. We're excited about this week's topic. As always, I am joined by my three compadres, Jason Eisengrein, retired senior executive from our OIG days, retired UPIC West director, and now our special director in charge of special projects over here, wearing a collared shirt. I like that. Matt Kachansky, Jason's counterpart at HHS OIG and the retired Northeast UPIC director, and he's a manager on our SIU team, also wearing a collared shirt. Apparently, there was a memo amongst the old gray guys. Wade apparently doesn't meet that because he's below 60. Wade, like me, wearing a t-shirt. Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA office and a member of our SIU investigative team. And as always, I'm still Eric Rubenstein, senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse here at Advise. Wade and I got the same memo, so we're wearing the t-shirts. We got a lot to cover today. So the big thing we want to talk about is there is a lawsuit that has been filed against, I believe it's four payers. And without going into the sort of gross details, we'll kind of speak generically, but two individuals who were partners and involved in the purchase of a number of rural hospitals here in the United States ultimately entered into agreements and put labs in these rural hospitals. And these labs were ultimately involved with performing urine drug testing. And in the rural hospital setting, there are a number of fraud cases that are out there around the country involving labs that get placed in rural hospitals. There is certain carve-out information out there that that reflects that on the payer side, payers reimburse at 100% of fee schedule under rural hospitals or critical access hospitals. It's a little bit of a separate set of rules that are out there. And long story short, two individuals were indicted. There was a hung jury on the first trial and an acquittal on the second trial. And the fraud scheme was that the urine samples were not actually being done at the hospital, that the hospitals were being used for what they call pass-through billing, which is a no-no, reflecting that the samples were actually being tested somewhere else, but that they were being reflective as being tested in the hospital to get that additional amount of money. So almost like a shell company where it was just being passed through. And ultimately, the two people that were charged were ultimately acquitted. And a lot of the issues that came out that resulted in what is now a lawsuit that it's been filed by the two now former defendants in this case against these four commercial payers is that these commercial payers colluded together to essentially stack the deck with false, fabricated, or misleading information that was then provided to the Department of Justice, and then DOJ relied upon that information to ultimately charge these people. And so the things that we want to talk about, and these are really the take-homes, is that this really is about preparation. When you read through the allegations, one of the allegations that's out there is that the data that was provided by DOJ had information that was not accurate. The big thing that came out in that complaint that's been filed against these four payers had to do with the fact that they were calling this the what they're calling the 141/22 issue. 141 has to do with what they call type of bill on what's known as the UB04. The UB04 is the form that hospitals submit to payers. It's a CMS form that the payers have adopted for the submission of claims. And that's for whether a patient is inpatient, or even in some cases, when we're talking about these labs, for outpatient or not even outpatient, just where the lab is doing the work, it goes on the UB04 and they use what's known as this type of bill, which kind of gives you an explanation about what that claim is. The other issue is what's known as 22, which is place of service, which is outpatient. And what you'll typically see is on a CMS 1500 form, which is your typical like Medicare Part B claim form, provider side is, you know, place of service. So what most people are familiar with is place of service 11 on a CMS 1500, which is office, it's for provider. And so number one is it's preparation. One of the things that this complaint talked about, and we're not going to say that this complaint is founded, unfounded, right? We don't know the facts. We don't know the underlying information. We have not, we weren't part of any of the trials. We have not looked at all the documents. We haven't spoken to anybody. We've got a 20-page complaint or a 30-page complaint, whatever it is, that that's talking about what these allegations are. And we just want to take an empirical look because from an SIU perspective, it's all about preparation. And one of the things that you know stuck out with me is in the complaint, one of the things that's alleged is that one of the payers had made some overtures that what they called the 141/22 billing combination is quote unquote rare. And when I read that, the very first thing that came to mind was it's so rare that it's impossible. Because 141, which is a 3-digit code, and wait, I'm going to turn to you because it's actually a 4-digit code. They take off one of the digits. But the 141 issue is a code that's relegated only to UB04s. And so, wait, I want to start to you because first and foremost is it's preparation. You got this complaint, and the very first thing that you did was you went online and you did some research about what does 141 stand for. And it turns out that in your basic research, you identified that type of bill, 141, has a bunch of different meanings that would have probably provided some clarity to this, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was more familiar with the CMS 1500 form than the UB04 just because of the type of work that I did in the past and frankly, the people that we just did more Part B than Part A. I had some agents working Part A, but again, less familiar with the UB04. So I did a little bit of research. I mean, just on the face of it, I mean, I knew that place of service 22, I understood what that was. And I knew that 141 basically is saying that the patient is not physically at the hospital and basically that the specimen was submitted to the hospital and not the actual patient. But I wanted to find out a little bit more because I was unfamiliar with what the 141 was. And I found out, as you said, it's actually a 4-digit code. The leading digit is a 0 that they drop. So we look at it as a 3-digit code, but so what's technically the second digit, but we'll call it the first digit. The 1 is for the type of facility and the 1 in 141 means that it's a hospital. 2 is like a SNF. There's different options, but in this case, a 141 is a hospital. The second digit is the type of care, and the 4 was, I forget what it was offhand, but the last digit was the sequence of care or the sequence of the bill. So even in looking at that, the 1 is obviously it's a hospital claim, but even getting back to the sequence of the bill, a 4 doesn't necessarily, it's not apparent that the 4 means that the patient was not at the hospital and it was only the specimen or the what they were testing in the lab. So it's a little bit confusing. And even looking it up, I mean, I would do a little bit more research and it probably makes more sense. But the 3-digit code, 141, knowing that what it means, but looking at the actual digits, it's not really that clear on what each digit represents.
Right. Right. But so the point, though, is that and when you look at the place of service 22, place of service 22 is outpatient hospital. So if you actually looked at the 141, it's actually inconsistent with 22, right? There's a consistency issue. But, you know, what boggled my mind is you read this complaint and, you know, we talk about this a lot. And when we're talking about SIU and process improvement, it's understand your data. And understand to know your policies, right? That's your initial triaging and vetting. You did the first thing that one would consider doing, which is what does 141 mean? What does 22 mean? How do these two interact with each other? You know, for me, I was familiar with type of bill, not solely 141, but I was familiar with the UB04 and what they call TOB type of bill because I've worked some Part A stuff, but here at Advise, about a year ago, we did a project for a large university-based healthcare system, and they had labs within that university healthcare system and received samples from outside sources. And we had one of our lab subject matter experts who has been qualified as an expert in state court previously. And she and I worked on a kind of a process document for this payer from a compliance perspective. And I became very familiar with type of bill. Like you, I did not do a lot of Part A cases when I was an agent, and they are nuanced. But I certainly understood that there was an inconsistency, because I knew that place of service 22 was hospital, and I knew that that was a CMS 1500. But, you know, the point being is that you get this information, and then you say to yourself, you scratch your head and you go, well, this still doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And so the next piece of this is you then go and maybe reach out to someone at the MAC, the UPIC CMS. So Matt, I want to go to you, because the next piece of this is interviews. You've done some investigative vetting, and you've clearly identified, if you're Wade and you've got the good common sense that you see this as an issue, you then say, huh, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't make sense. I don't really necessarily understand this. I've got to talk to people. And talking to people could be people at the MAC who do this work. It could be people on the payer, like in this case, maybe a commercial payer is paying this, but someone outside of the SIU, right? Someone in the payments section of this. But even getting down to, and just going back to Wade with this, is the issue here was that the samples were alleged to have come from outside, but were being billed, according to the complaint, were allegedly being billed as outpatient. You know, you got to talk to people. You got to talk to people at the payer in enrollment, in payment, outside of payment integrity. You got maybe talk to a couple of patients. Like, interviews become an important piece of that puzzle.
Absolutely. You know, with the 141-22, you know, controversy, you know, or the difference between them, I would go to someone in the claims adjudication department in those payers to find out, how do these codes get generated? What do they mean when you see them? Is it possible to see them both on the same claim? But none of that was done. They relied on the spreadsheets that were generated by the payers rather than getting the original documents. And then their interviews were based on the false positives that those spreadsheets gave them in terms of, oh, our crime is they're saying the services were done on an outpatient basis, but these patients never went to the hospital. So all of these claims are false. So when they talked to the patients, the only questions they asked them were, did you go to the hospital? And then, of course, they said no, because most of them were out of state. They were at rehab facilities. And so their answers were no. So like, ooh, easy peasy false claim, rather than asking them the real question of, did someone come and take a urine drug test? Was it used as part of your continuing treatment or rehab? And, you know, and then they'd have to do the follow-up questions. Where did those specimens go? And none of that was done because they relied on the false positives that initial data gave them.
Right. I mean, and part of that would have been something as simple as you talk to the patient and the patient says, well, I'm a recovering addict. I go to this place. And then your follow-up is going to be to go and interview someone at the place. Now, whether there's a nefarious relationship between the two, if there's an issue involving kickbacks or ECRA, right? So on the Medicare side, we've got kickbacks, the anti-kickback statute. You've got ECRA, which is the Eliminating Kickbacks and Recovery Act. In the lab space, it's very, very broad as far as that's concerned. So we're not even talking about the potential of there being a tainted claim from a kickback. That's not even what these people wound up going to trial for. These people essentially went to trial for healthcare fraud, alleging that they were submitting fabricated claims, claiming that they were getting the 100% reimbursement because of some outpatient that didn't occur. But, you know, one of the things that that came out in reading this complaint is that within the data analytics that was being done, this place of service code of 22 was put in by the payer, right? So Jason, I want to go to you, because a lot of this comes down to, right, it's all about documents. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, we teach and advise is that when you're doing an investigation, a review of documents will always lead to a review of other documents. Data will always lead to another set of data. Interviews will always lead to other interviews. But, you know, what it appears that never occurred in this was that nobody bothered to actually get copies of the underlying claims, the actual claim, other than a spreadsheet with a billing history that was later identified as having information that was put in there. So, you know, from a document perspective, like, to me, it doesn't sound like there's a heavy lift in going back to the payer and saying, hey, can you please give me a dozen of these UB04 forms, similar to where if we were in a trial with a Medicare case and we wanted to have representative examples of a CMS 1500, even though it's done through EDI, right, electronic data interface, you can still get it reduced to an actual form where you would have an actual document in which place of service 22 wouldn't have been there.
Well, I hate to be my usual self of wanting to look at this from an operational and project management approach, but really that's what caused this, at the very least, opportunity for process improvement, or more than likely a non-conformity, right? Like, so the outcome was much less than optimal and frankly put the individuals and the companies at risk over the lack of good operational procedures. So to your point, it's about the basics. It's about creating an investigative plan, which is based on an analysis and a review of, well, what is the concern, identifying the policies. And I guess if you're talking about from an agency that's a criminal investigative agency, of course, it would be the law that you're looking to prove. So what are the elements of proof that are needed? Start to strategize about what are the questions that you need to ask of witnesses to develop those facts and prove them. And then along the way, there should be project manager, so a supervisor, an ASAC, somebody who is voir direing the situation and making sure that the case is on track to a successful conclusion. Because I think when the four of us read this complaint, there was so many failures at the most basic level that it's really a travesty of justice when you get down to it, as it turns out. And I feel, I feel bad for the people involved, but I really think that it's, you know, what ADVISE is focusing on now, where we do a lot about improving SIU production, it's training, and also, again, the operational analysis.
You know, what's interesting to me, I shared this complaint with our lab expert, and she really is like tip of the spear. The things that she knows are really unbelievable. And she said it was like watching a Netflix show where it's 3 a.m. and you're 7 episodes in and the season ends and you're like, I just got one more. I got to watch one more. She said she just couldn't put it down. And she said within the first couple of pages, she realized where this was going and said, I can't believe that it went this way, that understanding lab processes from a billing and coding perspective, she said it was apparent that there were some things that didn't make a lot of sense. The thing that was interesting is that the way that the four payers all wound up being part of this lawsuit is that there actually was collaboration. And there was collaboration through a well-known program. And what it appears is that one of the payers provided this information that had flaws in it, and the other payers jumped on that information because it was being shared in a collaborative effort. And that really gets back to that you've got to, maybe be careful about what you wish for, because here is an instance in which we talk incessantly about the collaborative positive effects or the positive effects of collaboration. And here's an example where the one thing that we talk about wound up having what appears to be, because this is all alleged, right? So we're just looking at this as outsiders. is the negative implications of that collaboration was that you had collaboration that went on as the result of there being information sharing sessions that went on through a well-known collaborative system. Actually, two, now that I'm thinking about it, two different collaborative systems or organizations in which there was a failure. And the, you know, the fact is that had there been some basic background analyses done on this, you know, like I said, when I shared this with our lab subject matter expert, she immediately came back and said, here are the issues that I see. And the very first one that she brought up was, she's the one who said the fact that they used 141/22 as being rare, you know, and I said to her, it's impossible. And she said, right. She said, it's two different sets of codes on two different types of claim forms. The two never meet. And so she said, the fact that anybody was looking at this and no one bothered to highlight that as an issue is the one thing that was really, in her mind, it was the house of cards, that if you were able to just resolve that, most of these other things might have fallen at the wayside. Now, that doesn't mean that there might not have been some other arrangement that wasn't part of this, right? If there was an ECRA issue, if there was an anti-kickback issue out there, right? That's not part of this metric. The metric is strictly, and they weren't charged with that. They weren't charged with violation of ECRA. They weren't charged with violating the anti-kickback statute. They were charged with healthcare fraud, and I think there was a wire fraud in there or something. But it was really relegated down to this argument that the urine samples were being allegedly processed at the hospital lab as outpatient, which would have gotten them that 100%, but it was really not an outpatient. And so, go ahead, Jay.
One quick follow-up, too, is so when I was speaking to someone just at a really high level about this the other day, and the person worked in a job similar to where we came from, said, well, you know, clearly the ASAC in this situation wasn't doing his or her job because, you know, this should have been caught in the file review or something like that. And I said, you know, the reality is, you know, excuses are plentiful. The bottom line is, as a professional investigator, even if you have a retired in place or a missing in action ASAC for whatever reason, you know, you still have an obligation then as a professional investigator to challenge what it is that you're doing and finding. So using a peer to review what you're doing and give me your thoughts, that's the type of collaboration that frankly has to exist in an investigative team.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important point. And I think to think, you know, when Wade was an ASAC, and Wade, I want to go back to you, you're as good as you may have been and as good as you are, and as good as we may all think we are, we're not omnipotent. I mean, you readily said you didn't work a lot of Part A cases. I know I worked on very few in my career, and Jason and Matt, you know, you may have had more exposure to Part A at the UPIC than you did when you were an agent. I think that Part A cases are an area of weakness in the OIG and on the Mac and UPIC side. I think that there's, you know, those are high dollar, but, you know, this is, you know, go back to you, Wade, because you weren't really all that familiar with UBO4s. I was tangentially familiar with them. I got a little bit more familiar with them in the past year or so doing my project. But, you know, that being said, if an agent came to you with a case and you said, this is the thing, you wouldn't necessarily challenge the agent to say, well, what does 141 mean? And what is this? You're assuming that you're, to use Jason's vernacular, your professional investigator is coming to you with actionable intelligence, one of my favorite phrases, to be able to, you know, to understand where that is. But, you know, you went after reading this complaint and you just did a basic internet search to see what these things meant. And it immediately didn't pass your stink test. And you probably haven't looked at a UBO4 in most of your career, but it's a basic thing. But to kind of go back to what Jason's talking about, like as a professional investigator, when you're sitting as a supervisor, you're in a kind of a position where it's not so much challenging your people so much as it is just helping them in moving, ensuring that the cases move along, right? Because you can't be omnipotent on these things.
Yeah, and I think it depends too on the level of experience of the agent. If I'm doing a file review with an agent who's, you know, new within a year, I might have more questions, or I might question more of the procedures that they're doing, or the approach they're taking, as opposed to, you know, a 20-year veteran. But I think it goes back to the, you know, you have to challenge to a certain extent, and maybe I wouldn't do research, you know, but if I'm reviewing the case file, I should be asking the questions about, you know, the difference between a place of service 22 versus a 141. Those are conversations that, you know, should probably take place if it's not something that's, you know, a lot of stuff is apparent because you see it in case after case, but if it's something that's a little bit of a different issue, it should be a conversation. But one of the other things I thought was interesting that I would point out, kind of off the topic a little bit, but you'd referred to this a couple of times, Eric, as the reporting was not accurate or flawed, but there was actually, if you look at it, and this goes back to having to like confirm data, it's not like the data was misinterpreted or something like that. There were like overt acts to add the place of service 22 field to those spreadsheets, which is kind of shocking. I think that it's not just like a misinterpretation. It's kind of almost like an, you know, maybe things will come out further as we go hash through this and read into it further, but it's like an overt act, the type of thing you look for in a criminal case. It's like,
yeah,
going ahead and adding that field when it, first of all, wasn't there, right, and doesn't belong there, and frankly is the opposite of a 141 type of bill. When I first started reading that, I think our first initial conversations were, did they really actually, you know, add that? Right. It's kind of hard to follow.
I was really, now again, this is a complaint, right? We haven't seen any underlying documents. We've seen snippets. There are some snippets of testimonial transcripts from the testimony. It's all allegations. But when I read that myself, I was like, holy cow. I'd love to be able to talk to the DOJ about this, to ask them, you had on the first trial, they had a hung jury. And I get it. Like typically when there's a hung jury, DOJ will go and pursue it again. But it did come out in the first trial that place of service 22 was an appended column. And it's like, holy cow, right? I mean, it was an amazing thing for me to see that. So, you know, Matt, we're running out of time. I want to give you the last lick on this because you've done, you know, you read through it. We've talked about this. I mean, this has been like the topic of conversation for us for the past week. If the facts that are in this allegation bear out, the optics of this are really unbelievable. And, you know, just, and I want to give you the last word, but it just kind of goes back to Wade, like the 141-22 issue, you got to go back to people and say, what does this mean? And ultimately, if they've adopted codes that CMS uses, why wouldn't you want to go to the source, right? So I want to go to you for the final word and some comments on that.
Yeah, that first step of verifying the information that's in front of you, that simple information, what is this 141? What is 22? How did the 22 get into this claim? That the impact of not doing that is incredible, because, you know, you said it was a sad story because of the, you know, the impact on the defendants, they've lost their businesses and da 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 da. Think about the other side of that. The investigation went completely the wrong way. They weren't investigating what the right crime. We don't know if those other things had happened. So there might be that the defense knew that they had a tangential part of the case that they could confuse the jury with and get their clients off the hook for something that might have been a lot, you know, deeper than you know what was actually being investigated. Because if you look at the indictment, you know, it was false claims, some wire fraud, it's also money laundering and the whole thing about buying the hospitals under false pretenses to get them to bill for those things. Those things were never addressed because the investigation focused on where did the services take place. and that wasn't the issue, that was the crime, if there was a crime. So you've got a sad story that these people's lives were ruined, but you also have the sad story of did these people get away with something that because of the investigation starting off on that wrong foot.
So, right. And that really gets to the heart of kind of this process improvement piece for SIUs, that, you know, you may have an allegation, and we teach this when we do our on-sites, is you may have an allegation that's unfounded, but other things may come out that you the pivot, right? The pivot. Right. And that really is an important piece. So what I think ultimately the take home is there may have been something going on here. The problem is that they were looking under the wrong rock. Right. We don't know. Could there have been a kickback issue? Could there have been an ECRA violation? You see that with these UDT labs. So we, you know, it's not like we're saying something that's not a known thing, right? We see a lot in South Florida. There was a huge, the sober homes. Part of why ECRA was passed was to do this, you know, this whole issue with the opioid, epidemic and sober homes and buying patients and buying urine samples and kickbacks. That's a whole dirty underbelly. And we don't know if that was, and that's not the discussion here, but there was certainly things that were glaring that are the discussion that were just like reading this, you know, were crazy. It's obviously the complaint was just filed, I think, in March or April. It's fresh. It's just from the spring. There's a lot that's going to be uncovered. We're going to continue to track this and follow it. I mean, we could talk about this for hours. It is really a roadmap of, you know, where preparation is important. Know your data, understand your data. Document reviews, interviews, like these are kind of the basic things for vetting a complaint, but also understanding where the direction has to go. It kind of gets, you know, back to even, you know, it was what Jason says, which is you got to have some sort of a roadmap. You've got to have some plan. And I get it. Mike Tyson said very eloquently, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. I get that. And that happens. But, you know, it doesn't mean that you don't stay the course, which is basic investigative things. I mean, Wade puts it, you know, for a guy who didn't work a lot of these cases, this was a foreign concept to all of us. He went in and looked up the basic thing. And the minute that he looked it up, he said, that doesn't make a lot of sense. That alone could have been the difference between whether someone was charged the way they were or not charged the way they were. They may have still been charged, but there might have been additional things that could have been done. So, you know, we're going to continue to track this. We're going to continue to discuss this. It's definitely a topic of conversation that we're going to continue to have offline. As always, thanks for tuning in. Do your homework, do your research, vet your cases, vet your allegations. Again, if you're not getting our newsletter, hello at advise, advizehealth.com. Keep your eyes and ears open. Again, we've got our August LinkedIn Live coming up. Marshall Allen is going to talk a lot about his book. We're going to talk about SIUs. We just keep doing this stuff. We'll keep doing it. I look forward to seeing you guys on the next episode next week. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you at the next one.
Thanks, Andrew.